Welcome to this midweek Wednesday edition of Main Street. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. This is the last day of our fall membership drive, and a little bit later in the show, we'll interrupt Main Street to ask you, our listeners, to support Prairie Public. It's a good day to think about doing that. We will double whatever amount you choose to invest in us here at Prairie Public. A $10 per month Prairie Public membership nets us $20. A $20 a month Prairie Public membership nets us $40. For each and every dollar our listeners invest in Prairie Public, we are very grateful. And this is the last day, as I said just a moment ago, of our fall membership drive. If you haven't become a pledging member, this is a great day to do so, and we would be very grateful. Coming up a little bit later in today's show, Matt Olean and I will discuss a documentary about Christopher Reeves. It's powerful, and Matt really likes it. Plus, Matt will give us his way too early Oscar predictions, and he'll also recap this summer in movies. Also a little bit later, Dave Thompson, our legendary news director here at Prairie Public, he and I will review this week's news. But first, a piece from Harvest Public Media. Agriculture has replaced nearly all of the original prairie here in the Great Plains and Midwest, but a growing number of farmers are incorporating strips of prairie into their row crop fields. These colorful corridors help with soil and water quality and wildlife. As Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports, there are efforts underway to expand the use of prairie strips.
In a wide gap between two cornfields, Lee Tesdell points out native grasses like big bluestem and wildflowers.
Here's another one. This is wild quinine.
We're in a prairie strip. Here, it's around 40 feet wide, roughly the size of a county highway. This line of native perennials stretches to the horizon.
To a conventional farming, this looks like a weed patch with a few pretty flowers in it. And I admit it looks odd in the corn-soy landscape that we have in central Iowa.
Tesdell has three prairie strips on his century farm. One reason is to help protect his soil from strong winds and heavy bursts of rain, which are becoming more frequent.
I'm trying to be more climate change resilient on my farm.
Research shows that converting as little as 10% of a corn or soybean field into a prairie strip can reduce soil erosion by 95%. Above ground, the prairie strip's wall of stems act like a speed bump for runoff. Below ground, their extensive roots anchor layers of soil and absorb excess water. Prairie strips also keep nutrients like nitrates and phosphorus in fields and out of drinking water, and they provide critical habitat for pollinators and grassland birds, like this Dick Sissel. The conservation practice got its start at Iowa State University about two decades ago. Lisa Schulte Moore was a big part of that. During a recent outreach event, the landscape ecologist and 2021 MacArthur Fellow says large patches of prairie are vital, but
we've done research to really solidly show that a little bit of prairie, you know, can do a lot, right?
Schulte Moore credits early adopters and partners across the Midwest for helping prairie strips gain traction, but she says a monumental shift happened with the 2018 Farm Bill. That's when they were added to the Conservation Reserve Program. Nearly 23,000 acres of prairie strips across 14 states are enrolled. Landowners like Doug Doty get annual payments for taking vulnerable land out of production. He converted 16 acres of his north central Missouri farm into prairie strips in February.
So it's a little bit ugly this year, a lot of weeds growing up.
But Doty says it will get prettier with time. He knows this because over the last decade, he's turned several hundred acres of highly erodible ground into prairie. Doty says his conservation strategy makes financial sense and improves downstream water quality. He doesn't understand why more farmers aren't taking action to keep valuable nutrients in their fields.
And when cattle break through the fence or a gate is left open, we have a sense of urgency to get those cattle back in and fix the fence, right?
But there is a cap on the number of acres that can go into CRP.
So I think the intention of USDA dollars to adopt conservation at scale is really great, but voluntary conservation has its limits.
Omar DeCook Mercado worked on CRP policy as part of the Iowa State Prairie Strips research team. Now he's with a Colorado-based nonprofit. MAD Agriculture helps conventional farmers transition to regenerative ag practices like prairie strips.
They're climatically adapted in the Midwest to thrive. So it's a low-hanging fruit, essentially, on a farm. To bring in prairie on a Midwestern farm is a path of least resistance to incorporate biodiversity.
MAD Ag and Whole Foods Market recently launched a pilot program with 4 farms across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Montana to cover the initial costs of prairie strips and provide on-the-ground support. Back at Iowa State, Lisa Schulte Moore is also looking at the economics to scale up prairie strips. Someday soon, she hopes more corn and soybean fields will keep some color after harvest.
I dream of driving across Iowa winter and seeing various shades of greens and yellows and oranges rather than brown.
Those colors would reflect at least a small return of the prairie that once flourished across the Midwest. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
There's the fanfare. That means it's time to go to the movies with our friend, my colleague, Matt Olien. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
We have a fuller than normal plate today. We're going to talk about Superman, the Christopher Reeve story as your movie review. We're going to talk about your way too early Oscar predictions.
It's never too early.
Yeah. And then we're going to recap the summer in movies. But let's do start with the trailer from Superman, the Christopher Reeve story.
Everybody's looking for a hero. I am not a hero. That was a part. I played the part. I'm not that man.
Hands down, he was Superman from day one.
I realized that if I could pull off this part, it would change my life.
John Houseman said, Mr. Reeve, it is very important you become a serious classical actor. Unless, of course, they offer you a load of money to do something else.
He convinced me when I first met him that he would fly.
Doing things with my dad, it was all about activity and action. Riding bikes, playing soccer, skiing.
Carpe diem!
My dad was very competitive and he didn't necessarily slow down.
We said goodbye and he gave this wave.
That was the last time I saw him on his feet.
Mr. Reeve currently has no movement or spontaneous respiration.
Superman, crazy. Just that simple little thing over the horse.
I ruined my life and everybody else's. I won't be able to ski, sail, throw a ball to Will. Won't be able to make love to Dana. Maybe we should let me go.
She came flying in and she just yelled, I love you. I love you.
And then she said, the words saved my life. You're still you, and I love you.
He and Robin were such good friends because they could match each other.
Robin also had struggles that he dealt with his whole life, and I think that they both were aware of darkness.
Brother Chris is fighting like crazy. When you find people who fight like that but still keep their humanity, that gives you great hope.
That is tough because I can feel him, but he can't feel me.
It must have been hell for my mom, too, knowing what she had lost.
I felt I needed to do something, not just for myself, but for everyone else in the same condition.
The fact that Superman was in a wheelchair and was willing to go public with it was huge.
Help is on the way.
Christopher and Dana Reeve Paralysis Act.
People are literally walking because of him.
What is a hero? My answer was that a hero is someone who commits a courageous action without considering the consequences. Now my definition is completely different. I think a hero is an ordinary individual who finds the strength to persevere and endure in spite of overwhelming obstacles.
I wouldn't have missed this for the world.
Matt, that trailer was powerful, and as our listeners know, I rarely, in fact, I don't think I ever have played an entire trailer, but I did today. Wow. How did this movie do in your eyes?
Boy, it's really good. It's really powerful. Limited release. I want to let people know this is very, very limited release. It screened at Sundance in January. They're giving it a limited release so people can see it, A, and that it's also Oscar eligible. So the directors are Ian Bonhot and Peter Etegui. I don't know quite how to pronounce their names, but they've done a phenomenal job, not only with their interviews that they've staged, but also, you know, the archival footage. And so it's not just about the riding accident either. I mean, it is, but it also kind of retraces his steps toward this accidental stardom that hit him. He was basically doing off Broadway with Jeff Daniels and William Hurt in a play, and Daniels is interviewed in the film. And he got called to London to test for Superman. You know, he was not well known at all, and he gets the part. And next thing you know, he's a superstar. And so the film is, they do a really good job cross-cutting between people talking about the riding accident, which happened in 1995. And of course, he lived 9 years as a paraplegic. And, you know, he was confined to his wheelchair, confined to his bed. He became an activist with this kind of disability and people recovering from spinal cord injuries, which now through stem cells, you know, it's more possible. But they do a nice job of constructing how he became a star, his very difficult relationship with his father, who was a very difficult man. I enjoyed how he met the mother of his first two children, Gay Exton. He met her in London when he was shooting Superman. Of course, Dana Reeve was his wife, of course, who took care of him after the riding accident. But they do a really nice job of juxtaposing this monumental change in his life versus the career where he really got typecast as Superman. You know, he never had that other big hit outside of the Superman movies. He tried to be taken seriously as a serious actor, and he was in some good movies like The Remains of the Day and Somewhere in Time, but he was forever identified with Superman. And even though it made him a star, he tried to get away from it. I also enjoy hearing the talk about the casting. So initially they wanted a big star to play Superman, Craig, like Robert Redford or James Caan or something like that. And then they decided, let's go with an unknown and surround him with superstars. So then they get on the idea of Marlon Brando as Jor-El, Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor, and Reeve wanted to work with Brando and Hackman, of course. And it really worked. The first Superman movie is still kind of that first big-budget comic book movie. But once we get into the riding accident, it's just heartbreaking to watch the behind the scenes. They actually show the riding accident clip, which is eerie and scary to watch. Some heartbreaking moments, like when he realizes he's never probably going to move again. He kind of tells his wife, aren't I better off dead? And she says something to him that clicks in his brain to keep living. And I won't say what that is, but she said something that made him want to continue. The three kids are interviewed. They're a huge part of this story. He had two children with Gay Exton, one with Dana Reeve. They're all interviewed here. They all run the Christopher Reeve Foundation for spinal cord research and things like that. And I think the big part of the movie asks the question, what would we do in that situation, Craig? Would I just tell my son and daughter, you know what, I've had a good life, just let's cut the cord? Or would we continue on thinking there is that hope to walk again? I'm not sure what any of us would do unless we were put into that position. But the film becomes more and more heartbreaking as it goes on. And the person I went with had no idea, Craig, that Christopher Reeve was dead. And she had no idea that Dana Reeve, the wife, died 2 years later of lung cancer. I mean, it was just an endless tragedy that these kids had to go through. But like good filmmakers, they bring you back at the end. At the end, there's this hope. There's this dramatic triumph. As we see the advances since his death in spinal cord treatment of injury. So it's powerful. It's not that long. And I urge people to try and see it if you can. Again, very limited release. And I'm not sure where it's going for streaming after that.
Matt, I find it difficult at times to watch movies with people who are no longer with us, mm-hmm. or even television shows. The obvious one is Chandler in Friends. Yeah. Certainly this documentary Robin Williams is in this documentary too, for crying out loud.
Yeah, I wanted to, yeah.
I mean, and it's just difficult. In the trailer, Robin comes off really as a great, great person and supporter.
Yeah, so that is an interesting, I should have mentioned that. Robin Williams is in this movie a lot. He was his best friend. They went to Juilliard together. And obviously, we know how it ended for Robin Williams. I mean, absolute heartbreak that he hangs himself in 2014. There's a interesting soundbite. I don't remember who says it, saying, it might have been Glenn Close, who was a friend to both of them. She said, I think if Chris was alive, I'm not sure Robin would have killed himself. Now, we don't know that, but that's a heartbreaking answer. So Robin Williams, again, we see the funny side of him, and we see in certain clips that depressed side of him that he fought his whole life valiantly against. Another interesting thing that comes out in the film that I'd forgotten, Craig, is that sometimes Christopher Reeve, with his activism after the riding accident, was controversial. I mean, there was a commercial done where he kind of, they do this imagery where he gets out of his wheelchair and starts walking. And it was a commercial done, and some in the disability community didn't like that commercial because it, again, suggested there is something wrong with us. Our life is worthless unless we can walk. So that commercial was controversial. I'd forgotten about that. So it wasn't all just rah-rah Christopher Reeve stuff. It also deals with his kind of inability to commit. His parents were divorced, and you know, he eventually leaves the mother of his first two children. And you know, he had trouble committing too as a man. He was impossibly good looking when he was young, as you know, Craig. Just like you couldn't chisel someone. You couldn't chisel a man to look any better than Christopher Reeve looked when he was a young man. Right.
You know, it's said early in the documentary, from the day he was born, he was Superman. And boy, that's almost true.
And I think that's the moral of the film is, even though he had this horrible riding accident, he ended up being Superman. You know, he helped people. He helped people in the disability community.
Well, Matt, I hope this movie is shared in a larger way as it kind of grows. It's a movie I think that we deserve to watch, regardless of how it does or doesn't do within the award season, but it will be one to follow. What do you think it will be best hoped for with Academy Awards coming down the road?
It'd be in the documentary feature category. I'm sure it's eligible. We'll have to see what the voters in the Academy think, but typically if it's a film about someone in the movie industry, that's helpful to get a nomination, I would say.
All right, let's do our way too early Oscar predictions. Matt, of course, a lot of great movies that we've talked about here on Main Street. Give us your load for the Best Picture nominations and maybe the Academy Award winner.
So my earliest call ever, Craig, was the week after Heath Ledger died in 2008. I called it that he would win the Oscar posthumously. The film hadn't even come out, Dark Knight. That's my earliest call ever. I just had a feeling that he was going to win, even though no one had seen The Dark Knight. My other earliest call was when I saw the trailer to There'll Be Blood with Daniel Day-Lewis. Saw the trailer in August of 2007, and Mike Strominger, who used to work here, showed me the trailer. We looked at each other and said, it's over. He's going to win the Oscar, Daniel Day-Lewis. So sometimes you can just tell. What I'm hearing out there is Dune Part 2 is for sure going to be in the Best Picture mix. It's probably the best-reviewed film of the movie of the year so far. I'm also hearing a lot of buzz for a film called Emilia Perez, which no one has really seen yet, directed by French filmmaker Jacques Audiard and starring Zoe Saldana. This is a musical crime film that apparently the buzz on this is tremendous, but it's a foreign language movie, and only one film, non-English speaking film, has won Best Picture. That's Parasite. So I wouldn't quite get on the Emilia Perez bandwagon just yet. I'm hearing a lot about a film called The Brutalist with Adrian Brody. I'm hearing about a film called The Room Next Door, directed by Pedro Almodovar. Another movie directed by Sean Baker called Anora. Gladiator 2, a lot of buzz on this with Ridley Scott, 87-year-old Ridley Scott directing. There's a lot of buzz on that as well. So we'll have to see, but I do think Dune Part 2 is going to be right in the mix. I don't know if it's going to win, but those are some of the ones I'm hearing about. I'm also hearing a lot about Saturday Night, which is about the first ever Saturday Night Live TV show night in 1975. There's a lot of good buzz on that. That's directed by Jason Reitman. A Complete Unknown, the Bob Dylan biopic. If you haven't seen the trailer, watch the trailer. Timothée Chalamet. I said on Facebook the other day, if this movie comes off, Chalamet is going to win Best Actor because the trailer looks amazing. Edward Norton plays Pete Seeger. And if Chalamet can pull off the Bob Dylan trick to sing like him and be like him and perform like him, that could be a big winner. So too early to say Best Picture, but I will say if Chalamet pulls this off as Bob Dylan, I will call it that he'll win the Best Actor Oscar.
Others still think Horizon and An American Saga has a chance. I know you didn't like it.
It's the flop of the summer. It has no chance at all. You can forget about that. That is probably the biggest critical flop of the summer. Kevin Costner's Folly, I did not like it at all. It's a mess of a movie. So bad that they didn't release the second part. So that's not going to be in there. I'm hearing a lot for Best Actor about Daniel Craig in a movie called Queer, Ralph Fiennes in Conclave, Adrian Brody in The Brutalist. And for Best Actress, I'm hearing some talk about Tilda Swinton in The Room Next Door, Angelina Jolie as Maria Callas in Maria, Saoirse Ronan in The Outrun, and Carla Sofia Gascon in Emilia Perez. So those are some names to kind of keep an eye on as we move forward here. Once people get to see these movies. You know, sometimes a movie has buzz. Remember The House of Gucci a couple years ago? Until people saw it and they're like, I don't think so, you know? So you don't know until you see it.
Matt, what about Lady Gaga?
Yeah, hearing a lot of talk about her in the new Joker film. So she's kind of on that Best Actress. If it comes off, right? We don't know. No one's seen it yet. So if it comes off, she could get another Oscar nomination for that one.
Okay, Matt, your favorite movie of the summer. Which one was it?
Well, the big box office hits were Twisters, Deadpool and Wolverine, Beetlejuice, and Inside Out 2. I'm still amazed that Inside Out 2 did as well as it did. I did not see that coming. I did not see Beetlejuice doing $100 million in its opening weekend. That was amazing, too. But I really liked Longlegs and Maxine, two kind of horror slasher movies that came out this summer. I don't think I liked Maxine as well as I liked Pearl, which also starred Mia Goth as that same kind of character. But Longlegs, you know, Nicolas Cage, keep an eye out for that as a supporting actor nominee as we move through the year. He's creepy as heck, creepy as all get out in Longlegs, which is this slasher movie that takes place in the 1970s and 1990s. I like Maxine a lot too, but Longlegs is probably a slightly better movie than Maxine. So those were kind of my two favorites of the summer. But I did like Deadpool and Wolverine enough. I think there was a point where I wanted Ryan Reynolds to stop the stand-up comedian thing through the first hour. And the film really didn't pick up for me until kind of they assemble the gang, right? These kind of offshoot Marvel characters that form kind of like a little Avengers group. That's when the movie really picked up for me.
Matt, I've seen the Bike Riders talked about in some of the good movies of the summer.
I like the Bike Riders. I had a reviewer friend of mine who did not like it, but I did like it. Tom Hardy is always worth watching. It kind of captures a time and a place, 1960s motorcycle culture. I thought it did a pretty good job. It's maybe not going to be in the Oscar mix, I don't think, but I did like it. I agree with that. I agree with you on that one.
All right, Matt, what do you have coming up for us? What do we get to look forward to as fall sets upon us?
Well, we have the new Joker film coming. We have Saturday Night coming. And next week, I will talk about Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis. This could be, you know, the reaction at the Cannes Film Festival ranged from this is amazing to I can't believe this guy has ever directed a movie before. I mean, that some of the criticism was so harsh on this movie. So we'll see. It's not like his career is on the line. He directed Godfather 1, Godfather 2, and Apocalypse Now. So when he dies, his reputation is secure. But this is his grandiose pet project that he's wanted to make for years, and it could be really awful or really out there. I'm not sure. We'll find out next week.
All right, Matt, a little Oscar trivia here. The hottest year on record, we are talking about summer, of course, was 2012. So which movie won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 2012?
Argo, directed by Ben Affleck.
Well done. We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather around, everybody. I'll tell you a story.
There's the walk-up music, but Dave Thompson, I need to tell you, We use it with Danielle. So this is now the news department's
there you go.
Walk-up music. I can't just make this just for you, Dave.
No, that works for me. Sure, that's fine.
Welcome back to Main Street. We review the news with our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, how was your vacation?
Vacation was very, very nice. That's the longest time I've spent away from the station in one fell swoop. Yes.
Well, are you rejuvenated now? You've got the election season coming. You've got the legislature coming. You've got a lot of stuff coming down the road, Dave.
Yeah, and rejuvenation is not the word I would use at this point.
Well, we've got a story that keeps on giving, Dave, that we'll start with. The Board of Education decides not to hire an interim, and I use that in quotes, president at Dickinson State University. What's the latest there, Dave?
Okay, what's the latest? Board of Higher Education met today, and they were planning to hire an interim president. And they decided not to hire an interim president and say that Ty Orton is going to stay as an acting president. Now, under the board policy, if you name an acting president, you have to review that every month. If you hire an interim, then you're not with that every month prohibition there. So there's some interesting things going on. It's not really clear yet what happened when the board went into executive session. But I think there will be more explanation about what happened here. We think that maybe one of the four candidates that they had picked for the interim president may have backed out.
This seems to yield some more instability to an already tough situation.
Yeah, it does. And it's kind of sad at this point.
Dave, pertussis, whooping cough, continues to be a concern here in Cass County. And health officials have had a lot to say about it that you've reported about.
That's right. Danielle had a story about the 41 confirmed cases of pertussis since the beginning of the year, 15 confirmed since August 1st. That just, to me, you know, you didn't hear a lot about whooping cough for a few years, but now it seems to be back in the spotlight again.
It seems like this might be fueled by misinformation about vaccines, Dave. Yeah,
that's
Is what that
I hear.
What you're hearing?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm hearing, that there are vaccines, you know, that are out there for influenza, COVID-19, RSV. There are vaccines out there, but there's still some misinformation about whether or not the vaccines are safe or even effective. So it's interesting. I think whooping cough is part of the shots that people get before they get in school, correct?
Dave, there's staying on the vaccination, I guess, topic here. It's now time, folks are saying, to get our flu and our COVID-19 shot.
What I understand is that a lot of places are now offering it. If you go to a CVS pharmacy or a Walgreens, they offer them together. And many of the medical providers I've talked to are offering them together, both COVID-19 and influenza. Now, for some age groups, they're also offering the new RSV vaccine, which is now in a plentiful supply. So that's available, too.
Dave, Dem NPL Senate candidate is pushing back against GOP efforts to raise drug prices. And, of course, this is Katrina Christensen. What do you know about that?
Yeah, what that happens, Axios reported that there are Republicans in Washington, D.C. trying to repeal the Medicare drug price negotiation provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act. And she's saying we shouldn't do that because, you know, it's kept some drug prices down and they're worried that, you know, if you repeal this, well, then they don't have to negotiate with Medicare and Medicaid, for example.
Flying High Girls in Aviation Day is taking place at an event here in Fargo. What do you know about that?
What I know about that is that they're trying to get more women to be in aviation, not only as, you know, pilots in the cockpit or maybe attendants, but mechanics and ground crew and things like that. They want more women to be involved. And from what I understand, this Flying High Girls in Aviation Day event in Fargo has been around for a while, and it is attracting more and more women to that event.
Certainly with what happens at the University of North Dakota with all of their great aviation programs, this is a state to learn. Mm-hmm. There are some wonderful careers available to men and women.
Absolutely.
Dave, the investigation of the 18-year-old who was killed now 10 years ago at North Dakota State University is back in the news. And of course, I'm talking about Tom Bitterson.
Yeah, I remember that. And I did cover some of that, 10 years ago. But the case is still open, and you might call it a cold case, but then investigators are thinking they may have some new leads on it now. Remember, his remains were found at the Moorhead RV sales parking lot, but since that time, nobody's put the pieces together, so to speak, about what may have happened to Tom Bitterson.
Well, we'll certainly learn from you if anything is announced in the near future about that tragedy, for sure. Dave, the legislature looks like it's going to be extremely busy ahead of its 2025 season. There has been almost a record amount of pre-filed bills. What do you know about that?
What I know is more than 400 bills and resolutions have been filed for draft already, and this is pre-election. Now, one thing that I'm hearing anecdotally from some legislators is that a lot of the bills have the same type of subject line, and rather than going and looking for co-sponsors, people are looking to put their name up first so they get credit for it. So that, you know, it's a political game you play, and that's happening right now.
One of the most interesting things that I learned in my years of covering the Wyoming legislature is how hard attorneys work behind the scenes, drafting and redrafting and that adding amendments, et cetera, to bills. And it's work that nobody ever sees. And from this time until the end of the session, they are just so, so busy.
Yeah, North Dakota's legislative council is exactly like that. They are the unsung heroes of the legislative session because they don't get credit for, you know, drafting the bills. Legislator will come with an idea, and then these folks research it and put it into bill draft form, and that's not an easy process.
Dave, as we move forward, it's debate week starting next week here at Prairie Public. Let's go down the list and tell us what we should expect, could we?
Sure. This Thursday, we have a live one-hour debate for the North Dakota U.S. House race. That's between Republican Julie Fedorchuk and Democrat Trigvi Hammer. I am anchoring that one. I'm the moderator on that one.
And that's tomorrow night, Dave.
7 p.m. tomorrow night. That's Central Time. It'll be both on our radio and television services. Then you go to the 2nd of October. It's the North Dakota U.S. Senate debate. Republican Kevin Cramer, the incumbent. Democrat Katrina Christensen. Matt Olien is going to be the moderator there, and I'll be producing the debate. Then you go to the governor's debate, which is our, I call our three-ring circus, and I only do that tongue-in-cheek, because you have Republican Kelly Armstrong, Democrat Merrill Pepcorn, and Independent Michael Coachman, who also qualified for the ballot. All three will be in there for a live one-hour debate on the October 10th. It's a Thursday at 7 p.m. And then Tuesday the 8th, a couple days earlier, Minnesota's 7th District Congressional Republican Michelle Fishback will be against Democrat A. John Peters, and Madeline is doing that one.
Dave, if I were to ask you today to maybe predict for us October 10th, October 15th, what we'll be saying about the debate season here in North Dakota, what do you think it is we might be talking about?
I think what we might be talking about is how these candidates are going to approach what we call the kitchen table issues, the issues that are really concerning to people in North Dakota and Minnesota. And there are a lot of things going on there. And I think we're going to hear a lot of discussion about the Farm Bill. And that is still coming up.
Our news director, Dave Thompson, he's with us each and every week here at Prairie Public when he's working. Of course, not when he's on vacation. But Dave, we are happy that you are back in the studio with us.
Well, I appreciate that, Craig. Thank you so much.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Daybook for September 25th. Ever since the establishment of the Minot Air Force Base and the Grand Forks Air Force Base in 1957, North Dakota has been considered a potential target for enemy nuclear weapons. This knowledge created anxiety among some of North Dakota citizens. One response has been to build fallout shelters in backyards or basements. On this date, in 1961, the Bismarck Tribune reported that Bismarck had issued its first building permit for a fallout shelter. Frank M. Rose, an electrical engineer for Dakota's Electric Cooperative, paid $1 for the permit and began constructing a basement fallout shelter at his home on South Highland Acres Road. Other families in Bismarck had built fallout shelters before 1961, but city officials had not yet written an ordinance governing the structures. Frank Rose devised his plan for a fallout shelter partly in response to rising tensions between the U.S. and Russia during the Berlin Crisis of 1961. President John F. Kennedy had met with Russian leader Nikita Khrushchev in Vienna, with Khrushchev demanding that the U.S. withdraw its soldiers from West Berlin within 6 months. That's when President Kennedy publicly called for more public and private fallout shelters in case of a nuclear attack. Rose responded to Kennedy's plea. It took him just 3 weeks, working in the evenings and on weekends, to build his do-it-yourself fallout shelter with the help of his two sons. Using concrete blocks and some lumber, Rose created a space measuring 8 feet by 9 feet with a ceiling height of 6 feet, 4 inches. The Rose family outfitted the shelter with food, water cartons, a kerosene lantern, first aid supplies, and even a deck of playing cards, preparing to endure a 2-week period following a potential nuclear explosion. Rose commented that he would be perfectly satisfied if he never had to use the shelter for its intended purpose, as it could serve other functions. "It makes a good fruit cellar," he said, "or even a nice quiet place to get away from the rest of the family." As decades passed and the world did not end in nuclear Armageddon, thankfully, the Rose family's fallout shelter proved to be a mighty fine fruit storage cellar. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Steve Hoffbeck, retired MSU Moorhead history professor. I'm Ann Ahlquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are grateful that you've spent time with us. You still have time in this hour to pledge your support here at Prairie Public. We would be deeply appreciative of that as we wrap up our fall membership drive. Tomorrow, Main Street will be live from the Norsk Hoots Fest. That's from Minot, and we hope you can join us again tomorrow here on Main Street.